The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're about to have a conversation with James Lee III, who's a composer, an associate professor at Morgan State University, and his piece, Kupcha, will be Harriet's Drive to Canaan, will be played by the BSO, a world premiere, this Friday, September 23rd, at 8 o'clock, also a show on Saturday, and James Lee is come down from Morgan to our studios in Hamden to grace our studios. And James Lee III, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So your name preceded you in this world. I've been looking forward to meeting you, and I'm glad you could come in here today. It's great to have you here.
Oh, wonderful.
So let's talk about the piece, Kupcha, and what you wrote here and what is going to be performed. Give a general sense of it for our listeners.
Sure. Well, Kupcha is a musical commentary on the life of Harriet Tubman. The word Kupcha is actually a biblical Hebrew word for freedom, but more freedom from slavery.
Right.
And many times the slaves identified with the ancient Hebrews from the Bible in their experience in Egypt. And obviously the word Canaan has to do with the Canaan land or the promised land, in this case for the slaves. It was their promised land to go to the northern states or even as far as Canada. So this piece is actually commenting on various aspects of her life. And I also quoted some Negro spirituals throughout, not in whole, but only parts of those spirituals, to kind of give an idea of the setting back in the 19th century.
It's always interesting to think about the mind and soul of a composer that reads a history, like you must have sat and read volumes about Harriet Tubman and thinking about her life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Looked at her pictures and just thought about her.
I did. I even drove to the Eastern Shore to try to see if I could look around at the scenery and try to imagine what it must have been like to live in that part of Maryland.
This is where I think people who do not play music or especially people who don't compose music.
Mm-hmm.
People don't play music because they're different things, but different talents in many ways. But the idea of how you transfer the literate mind into a musical interpretation, to be able to describe that
mm-hmm.
is a hard thing to do.
Sure.
But try anyway.
Yeah. And you know, for me, it was difficult as I was thinking. I actually did not – the beginning of the work is actually not the first part that I actually composed. What I was thinking about mostly after my experience driving over to the Eastern Shore and reading biographies about Harriet Tubman, I actually composed a piece of music where I tried to emulate her emotions that she experienced after she escaped from slavery and she longed for her parents. So I tried to write harmonies that were more a little more on the darker side, not dissonant, but harmonies that would kind of evoke this emotion using the strings. And then there's one solitary instrument with the English horn actually emulating Harriet Tubman and her character as it goes throughout. And that particular English horn has certain characteristics as it goes throughout the piece. So that's one thing I tried to do is I tried to convey the musical ideas.
So why the English horn? And you said to me here before we went on this conversation on the air here that a number of African-American composers of the past have used the English horn to talk about that.
Yes, that's interesting. For me, I hadn't consciously thought about the English horn as something that I said, okay, I will do this in terms of using Harriet Tubman. But after I started to sketch out the work and then play some of it at the piano, I thought, English horn would be a wonderful instrument to personify Harriet Tubman. It's a woodwind instrument that has a lower range than the oboe, but it doesn't normally play in the higher registers. And Harriet Tubman, being a female, she was also considered the Moses of her people, this kind of very manly leadership role that she had. And then looking back on that choice to use the English horn, I thought of it more out of intuition and my own feelings and ideas about what I want to convey musically in the piece. And then as an afterthought, I remembered, wow, William Grant Still and William Dawson used English horn as important solos in their works. And Antonin Dvorak, who so many times talked about the his desire that American composers would use more music that was based off of African-American and Native American influences.
He did.
Yeah.
He was almost obsessed by it.
Yeah. And I find it interesting because this concert with the BSO, the second work on the program is Dvorak's cello concerto.
Oh, wow.
So it's interesting. It would be the second time I would have had a world premiere with the same cello concerto of Dvorak on the same concert.
So we're going to play a piece by an African-American composer. So I guess we better get some Dvorak in there, right? So in creating this piece, when you think about the characters and about the story, is that when the instruments and the kind of melodic interpretation through an instrument come to you, or is it the melodic interpretation that comes to you and then you figure out the instrument?
Well, I thought a lot about the characters of the story first, and then I thought about, in particular, what instruments I might want to use in certain passages. For example, the beginning of the work, I wanted to actually sound like we were already in the middle of a story in progress. So it was like we are just passersby, and then, we look, and then we see something happening, and then we are very drawn to it, and then we start to pay more attention to the story. So as the work begins with this kind of pyramid brass passage and the strings, then there's this marimba solo that kind of gives us the effect of a chase or a runaway slave at the very beginning of the piece.
And so when you compose pieces like this, I'm trying to imagine you sitting there. Do you compose them on a piano? Do you write the scores and hear it in your head? How do you approach it?
It's a combination of all of that, actually. I hear some of it in my head. I do some improvisation at the piano and come up with various ideas, and then I work them out at the piano. But sometimes I find the piano can be limiting to me because I might end up spending more time improvising than anything else. So I do some of it at the piano, and then I have a computer notational program that I can write right into the program without using a piano or short scores, and I can write actually into the full score.
Ah, so you can actually sit there and hear the music in your head, in your heart, in your soul as you're kind of working this out.
Yeah.
Get on the computer and write the notations down.
Yes, exactly.
And then go back and play it.
Yeah. So I do some of both. Do that, and then I also play it and then at the piano, and then put it in the computer to make sure I like it. And if I don't like it, then I can take it out or enhance it or do whatever I want to.
So, and when you do that, are you also hearing the various instruments at the same time?
Yes.
You can kind of pull out the pieces at that moment?
Sure, because I have I've been doing this for a while now, so
yeah, you have.
I have a good sense about the idiomatic aspects of various instruments. So I know that an oboe will sound good here, but a bassoon would sound better here, or a violin or whatever instrument would sound better in certain passages.
So by the way, folks, if you're just tuning in, and you can always hear this on the web as well, we're talking with James Lee III. Chufsha, we're talking about, which is Harriet's Drive to Canaan, his latest orchestral composition that will premiere this weekend at the Meyerhoff for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra at 8 p.m. on Friday, again at 8 p.m. on Saturday. James Lee III is a associate professor of music and composition.
Yes.
At Morgan State University, here at Morgan State University. Your sojourn, you grew up in Michigan.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you grow up in a home full of classical music, or?
No, you know, it's interesting that you ask me that. My parents told me before I was born, my mother used to play a certain radio station in one small town called Berrien Springs, Michigan. And there's this classical music station, and she used to play that music, and I used to hear, I guess, hear in the womb. Yeah. Right. So it started very early, but I never really paid much attention to classical music until I started piano lessons at the age of 12.
And so piano lessons at 12. Age 12.
Yeah, so I started late. But once I started piano lessons, then I really got much more involved in classical music.
And that's really interesting that you started so late. Mm-hmm. And my guess is, did you get serious at 12 or did you get serious later?
I actually got serious at 12. Before, my dad tried to get me to take piano lessons, but I thought it was something only for girls. And I just wanted to play the sports and all the other things that boys do. So I said at an earlier age, around 6 or so, I didn't want to play. But when I started at 12, I actually passed through various levels in weeks. So a week I would pass a book, a certain level of piano music.
It was your brother or your father who's the minister?
Oh, my brother's the minister.
Your brother's the minister. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
So your father wasn't the minister?
No.
Okay. So when did this kind of passion for knowing that what you really wanted to do with life was be a composer, when did that kick in, and how did you go after that dream?
Well, it came at various stages. When I was 16, I had a friend who was a pianist and a composer, and she composed music for the talent shows in high school. So I decided to do the same thing, and I ended up winning the talent shows. And then I decided I wanted to be a pianist. So I went the route of piano performance in my undergraduate years. But then after my senior recital, even before my senior recital, I thought, you know, it's probably better for me to pursue composition, because that was something I always wanted to do on the side. Even when I was practicing my Beethoven sonatas and Chopin etudes, I would think, well, I want to write this piece or I want to write this piece. So at the master's level, I decided I wanted to pursue composition.
And you graduated when?
In 2005 with the doctorate, but the master's was 1999. No, that was 2001. I'm getting confused. 2000. Yeah, 2001 was the master's, yes.
So this is it's interesting to me, what is instructed by you and John Chapman, who I met the other week from Morgan State University, is this, and I don't think he gets enough play, or people don't get enough recognition, or that there is this world of young African-American composers, musicians, composers and singers, mm-hmm. in the classical world that bring the deep roots of African American culture to this field of artistry, but doesn't get the play that others do, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Though it's beginning to.
Yeah, and we see some of that in my work with the spirituals. They're not presented in a way one might expect them to be presented, in terms of presenting the spiritual as a whole entity within the music. I actually quote some of the spirituals in part, maybe just a few measures here or there, just to kind of evoke the idea or the era from where the Harriet Tubman was taken from, just to kind of give an idea, okay, we have this particular character, this dramatic action will take place here, and then here is another spiritual that refers to slavery in particular, or to the freedom from slavery throughout the work. But it's not something where the spiritual is the focal point of the particular work.
Right, exactly.
Sure.
And you used the word earlier in our conversation, Negro spiritual.
Yes.
And then alternatively, you used the word African-American, describing the larger culture and where things come from.
Sure. Yeah, that happens. The Negro spiritual, something that obviously developed back in the 19th century, and then later Harriet Tubman sang some of them, actually, as she presented herself to the slaves. As she was coming back, she would actually sing songs like Go Down Moses, or hum them so that the slaves would know that she was nearby and that they need to get ready. And, of course, Negro spirituals, sometimes Negro spirituals are just referred to simply as spirituals. But what's interesting about them, that's something obviously very unique to the culture that can really be, someone can really identify with. And once they hear this particular work in certain passages, that can evoke certain emotions, even with the text. Even though there's no text that's actually sung throughout the piece, just hearing parts of the melody will kind of evoke these emotions throughout.
It's interesting, and I think that it's just in terms of language, when you talk about quotes from Negro spirituals that you put in your pieces.
Sure.
And when people hear quotes, they think of something as literary.
Mm-hmm.
And you obviously you're talking about musical quotations,
sure,
pieces
sure.
that come out of the, mm-hmm. the sound itself.
Mm-hmm. And this is actually a new project for me. I haven't really done this before. Most of the music I compose is basically original ideas that I have melodically and harmonically. But for a project like this that the BSO specifically asked me for, a Harriet Tubman piece, I thought, well, how would I connect the audience with the work like this? And the best way I thought would be to use some familiar tunes that I could use throughout the composition that the audience might be able to connect with.
I was thinking about this before we started. I'm really happy they're doing this in a month that's not February.
Yeah, me too.
That's good. That's a step up.
You know, funny you say that. In my career, I've actually been blessed that my all my premieres have been in months that haven't been February.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's a good sign.
Yeah.
That's a good sign. That's a great sign.
Yeah.
So when you look at the pieces you write, I mean, are you someone who is, and just in terms of your intellectual interest, kind of think a great deal about history, about passage of life? And then you have to bring that into a musical interpretation. I mean, is that you?
Well, this piece is a little different than what I usually do. A lot of my interest has to do, especially with the biblical books of Daniel and Revelation.
I have noticed that.
Yeah, because those books really resonate with me in terms of the imagery there and the prophetic expectations that I have from reading those books. And I feel like some composers, they like to use more mythological subject matter in their works, but I like to use images specifically from those books to give people a little more hope, because a lot of people do not understand. In the books of Revelation, they think it's all just doomsday and there's no hope there, but that book is actually full of hope, and I try to convey some of those ideas in the music.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So are these books that you have been kind of, the two books, one Old Testament, one New Testament, that you have been kind of obsessed with most of your life?
Yeah, I've studied them. Yeah, they're part of my whole background, especially in terms of religion and church. That's a big part of our teaching as well. And I've actually done a lot of studies with people on those particular books.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah. So that's why you focus so deeply on these pieces.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's go back to talking a little bit about Chupsha, the Harriet's Drive to Canaan that people will hear this weekend with the BSO at the Meyerhof. The piece that the people hear under us at the moment is part of Harriet Tubman's struggle. Talk about how you, as people listen to this, we'll stop for a minute. And since what people are listening to there, what's going on with Harriet Tubman here? What were you composing for that particular piece? Talk about how you created that and what people are listening to.
Okay. Well, one passage that really caught my attention was when Harriet Tubman was in, even before, I'll talk about that a little bit later, but when she left slavery, I thought how she was very much sad that she was alone. Even though she was happy she escaped slavery, she wanted to really go back and take her elderly parents out of Maryland, take them to the northern states or further northern states, and other slaves that she really felt a passion for. So she went back several times to take back slaves. And that's what I was really trying to convey, is that depth of her emotion. And also throughout the work, Harriet Tubman, she never had a biological child of her own. And that void that I think she felt in terms of some of the, what I've read, I tried to convey in her in the work that I composed. And then one contrasting passage that I really think that would resonate with listeners would be the story where she's in Troy, New York, and she actually pretended to be an old decrepit lady in a courthouse. And as the policemen were escorting this fugitive slave down the steps, she yelled out to the crowd, "They're coming!" And then the whole crowd gets involved with the police and the pro-slavery men that were trying to take this fugitive slave back to the South. They're struggling to take the slave, and Harriet Tubman's struggling with them, and they're beating her over the head, and she's trying to take the slave away, and she's even threatened that she'd rather the slave drown in the river than go back to slavery. So that particular passage, the whole orchestra is like mayhem. There's all this dramatic action in all parts of the orchestra, and it ends with very bitingly dissonant chords in the brass and in the strings, until that finally dies away. And when the slave is actually back in the hands of Harriet Tubman and her supporters, then this very there's this E-flat major passage that almost sounds like "We Shall Overcome," but the tune is actually "No More Auction Block for Me." And that tune is played again in the oboe, and then the English horn and oboe. But there is this counterpoint in the orchestra that is just a little eerie, because even though he's free, not everything was, of course, very perfect for his condition.
This is Charles Knowles?
The Charles Knowles, yeah. Right. And that happens close to the end of the piece.
But let's hear a little bit of this for a minute. So your way of approaching music has, to me, an interesting combination of a lot of influences, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And you'll tell me I'm full of it and don't know what I'm talking about. Or you'll tell me I'm right, or somewhere in between. But it seems to me part of it is embedded clearly in the cultural and musical power of the African American world. Part of it seems to come from very classical composers, symphonic composers like Beethoven. Mm-hmm. Some seem to come, another influence seems to be coming in from like the Adams side of kind of these modern, you know, and almost minimalist in some senses, 20th and 21st century composers, and all these kind of, and you are a 21st century composer.
Sure.
So it seems like those influences have come in to help, and you've created your own out of that. Is that about where you are coming from?
Yeah, it's about right. It's funny you said that. One of my favorite composers, besides some of my teachers at the University of Michigan, is John Adams. I've been listening to some of his work, but not recently. But I really, one work that really struck me was his work "City Noir" that was premiered in Los Angeles.
Oh, I've heard that.
Yeah,
that's a beautiful
piece. Yeah, it's a wonderful piece. Yeah. So that really,
I don't think the BSO has played that yet. The BSO has played some Adams, a lot of Adams.
Yeah,
but I don't know if they played. They may have played. I'm not sure, but.
No, I don't, recent years I don't think they've played it. But, yeah, some of Adams' music, and then the way Beethoven uses a motive, and then he works it out, and especially as seen in a piece like the Waldstein Sonata, his piano sonata.
Yeah.
Something like that really, of course, struck me as something I should really study and kind of figure out how I would like to approach something like that in my own music in terms of developing an idea.
Of all the 18th, 17th century composers, do you think Beethoven is at the pinnacle of that, or Mozart? I have to ask you this question.
Oh, for me, For me, every time.
Or is it somebody else?
When I'm teaching my form analysis or any theory course, 9 or 10 times out of 10, it's Beethoven over Mozart.
So,
yeah.
So, in this piece that's being played, how many acts are in this piece? How many parts is the symphony?
Oh, to the actual instrumentation?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't really count. I know it's probably – I mean, basically, the Widowin section will be about 12 people playing. The brass will be 11, the three percussionists, plus a timpanist, one harp, and then a string section of probably maybe at least 50 people playing or so, maybe even 40. I haven't done all the counting, but it's a large size.
So when she's rehearsing the orchestra when Marin Alsop is conducting the orchestra, I mean, rehearsing with the orchestra, mm-hmm. are you there for all the rehearsals?
Yes, I will be there.
And so there's a dynamic between the two of you as this is being created with the orchestra on stage?
Yes, but it's interesting. Usually with a rehearsal session like this, a lot of the actual discussion has taken place before the rehearsal.
Uh-huh.
So I've already spoken to her last week, and I clarified some things, and she expressed some of her concerns of clarification in the score. And then once she rehearses, then ideally it goes much smoother. So I might have to make a comment maybe here or there after they're actually playing, or maybe a few times during it.
So tell me, and just personally, I think that this is important for lots of reasons, and especially parents and young people hearing this program, is that the avenues of a musical future for young people can be very broad if you don't limit yourself to the genre of the moment, the pop mm-hmm. genre of the moment,
mm-hmm.
and how that can be extrapolated out to a world like yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really can be. For me, I've actually been blessed because I had aspirations to do exactly what my teachers at the University of Michigan were doing, and so far it's working out nicely. Because my mind was a little more narrow in terms of what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do composition. I listen to a lot of music, and I do a lot of networking and just really staying in touch with people and trying to produce good work so that builds a reputation that I can hopefully get other opportunities later.
I'm sure you will. And it's very exciting for you to have your – it must be very exciting any time you hear your work being performed by an orchestra like this, especially an orchestra of the character BSO and others that are like major orchestras
yes.
playing
mm-hmm.
your work.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's very, very wonderful.
So, folks, I'm going to encourage all of you, if you are around this weekend, to take either Friday or Saturday night at 8 o'clock, September 23rd or the 24th, to hear Hufsha, Harriet's Drive to Canaan, this incredible orchestral piece composed by James Lee III, a professor here at Morgan State University in music and composition. The BSO will be performing this world premiere. For tickets, you can call 410-783-8000. And there are many gems in this town. We've had one on here for the last half an hour on the Mark Steiner Show. And James Lee, thank you so much for coming in today, and good luck with this.
This
is fantastic.
My pleasure.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And we'll go out with a little piece of the music. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.